from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a new interview with Tiffany McDaniel, who's been on the show once before. Her new novel, Betty, based on the life of her mother, comes out tomorrow from Knopf. Tiffany McDaniel is a novelist, poet, and visual artist born and raised in Ohio. She is also the author of The Summer That Melted Everything. Here's a little information about Betty. A girl comes of age against the knife. So begins the story of Betty Carpenter, born in a bathtub in 1954 to a Cherokee father and a white mother. Betty is the sixth of eight siblings. The world they inhabit is one of poverty and violence, both from outside the family and also devastatingly from within. The lush landscape, rich with birdsong, wild fruit, and blazing stars, becomes a kind of refuge for Betty. But when her family's darkest secrets are brought to light, she has no choice but to reckon with the brutal history hiding in the hills, as well as the heart-wrenching cruelties and incredible characters she encounters in her rural town of Breathed, Ohio. But despite the hardship she faces, Betty is resilient. Her curiosity about the natural world, her fierce love for her sisters, and her father's brilliant stories are kindling for the fire of her own imagination, and in the face of all she bears witness to, Betty discovers an escape. She begins to write. She recounts the horrors of her family's past and present with pen and paper, and buries them deep in the dirt, moments that have stung her so deeply she could not tell them until now. Inspired by the life of her own mother, Tiffany McDaniel sets out to free the past by telling this heartbreaking yet magical story. I spoke to Tiffany last week by phone. I hope you enjoy our conversation. It struck me as I read Betty that you come from a long line of storytellers and writers. Your mother's father told wonderful stories informed by his Cherokee background, and your mother wrote stories in order to process and survive, you know, sadness and poverty and racism. So I wonder if you want to just start out by talking about coming from that background and deciding to write a novel based on your mother's life.
Storytelling is definitely so important on that side of family, you know, especially when I'm thinking about Landon, who was raised with several generations in the same household, and the elders in his household only spoke Cherokee, and he was of a generation that had to speak not only Cherokee from his culture, but he also had to learn how to speak white man's English, because that's the world he was sort of entering. And so for him, when he was speaking with these elders, they used storytelling as that universal language. It was something that they all spoke, and it was a way, especially that we see with indigenous cultures, how they share that history. This story is for them more than just myth and fantastical legend. It's a way of discussing their history, their origins, the things that had happened to them, and they're passing this down as an oral history and an oral tradition in the form of storytelling. And so Landon really preserved that from his childhood. And when he became a man, he also used story to instill those same traditions and values and culture in his children. And we see that especially with Betty. She's someone who uses her father's story as a compass on her path. And, you know, I look at that poem that starts the book out, My Broken Home, which is a poem that my mother Betty wrote for the book. Mm. And we that history and that connection, and even in just that brief few lines, we also see her relationship with her father that was still so powerful all these years later. As we say at the end of the book, you know, the ripples have not yet died or faded, and those ripples are kind of eternal, that bond between father and daughter, and using story as a way to sort of compass ourselves on our path forward. So story and storytelling was just so valuable and such a rich experience to that side of the family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Landon is such a presence in the book. So many moments of his wisdom and kindness. And yet, you know, you had this inability in the book, and I do hope that you'll, you know, step in and correct me if I'm assuming certain truths out of your fiction, but, you know, you seem to have this inability to rise above the lack of opportunity that was out there, and so they always pretty much were living in poverty. And I loved reading about him, the stories, the lessons, the kindness, the medicine he practiced. There's this one line early on where she says, his voice seems to soar above the hills around us. And I thought that just so embodied the way that she admired and looked up to him and the power he had in the family. So, and it sounds like you kept his name the same.
I did, yeah. And Papa Landon, he was, because for the book, I had done Q&A sessions with mom and other family members. And Landon had died over a decade before I was born. And so I really shaped him from their memories and from those stories of him. He dies at home, as he does in the book. And so he was a character that I had to meet through their stories and through their memories. And what I wanted to preserve from those sessions with his children and with his wife was how incredibly supportive and empowering and loving he was to them as a father. And you know, I have very fair skin, but mom has brown skin and papa had brown skin, and they were living in predominantly white communities. And so, you know, I listened to those experiences that he had of trying to get that opportunity in communities, but he was instead, you know, attacked and in some cases beaten up just right, because of the color of skin. And so we see a man who is really struggling for that significance. He says at that point in the book that, you know, starting out, he might have felt like he was important, but then he came to realize he was just the filler or the paint drop on the portrait of a greater man. And I think through relationship with his children and through his stories, he's really trying to find his place in history, and he's trying to find that significance because, you know, historically in these communities, he was kind of beat down and called all these different names, and he's trying to rise above that. And in Betty's eyes, he is someone who has already soared. And so it takes him a while to sort of see that through the lens of his children, because he's always seen himself through the lens of, you know, racist and kind of that hate-filled vessels within the community. And so he sort of, it takes him a while to see, but Betty as a child already sees him as someone who's soaring. And so for me, I really wanted to preserve those feelings that they had for their father and preserve just how important he had been to their lives.
Yeah, definitely came through so strong. I want to talk about the racism, but before we get to that, I have a question just about like a craft question. I want to talk a little bit about foreshadowing and what it offers to a narrative. You do a wonderful job of shaping this book in lots of different ways, and foreshadowing comes up sometimes. Do you mind if I just mention a few different examples and then we can talk about them?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, feel free.
Sometimes you offer the hint of a larger meaning in a simple description, and one of those that jumped out at me was, I'm still a child, only as tall as my father's shotgun. You have more of a straight foreshadow. Once in a while, you say, where I came from was a family of 8 children. More than one of us would die in the prize-winning years of youth. So that was very straight. Then there's this kind of ironic or innuendo type of suggestion of foreshadowing, where at one point Landon says to his wife, you ever been pinned down before? Can't stop what somebody is doing to you. That ever happened to you? And he's referring to something that's happened to him. But we later come to learn that, in fact, she has had that experience, but she's never shared it with him. So then, and then finally, and I loved this one in so many ways, there's the filling in background with the help of a story, which sort of, it's a little bit opposite from foreshadowing. In fact, it's sort of filling in background, but it's the Peacocks were the family that lived in their home in Southern Ohio before they lived there. And there's this incredible story about the Peacocks having all just basically disappeared one day, and the only thing left were these bullet holes in the walls. And you write, The story about the peacocks is true. Freya touched the bullet hole in the wall that separated the living room from the dining room. I thought that was made up. So, I mean, there's all these different ways you have of bringing us into story. Sometimes you're, you know, sort of hearkening what's going to come. Sometimes you're filling in what's already happened. But I love that it's not always just straight storytelling. It's coming in lots of different directions, from lots of different directions. And I just wondered if we can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, another one that comes to mind is where Betty and Flossie are kind of at the train tracks. And so we do see those different foreshadowings.
Right.
I think too, from that, you know, the narrator, I get asked, you know, is Betty young when she's the narrator of this book? But when I look at it, you know, Betty is an older woman. She's looking back and telling this story. And she's someone who has surpassed the age of her mother and father, someone who is the last of her family. And I wanted her voice to be aged by that wisdom and that experience and the blessings and the curses of the past. I mean, the child is still there inside her, but
right.
The woman she has become is the voice we hear. And for me, the foreshadowing sort of allowed her to tell this story in pieces that also felt comfortable for her. She wasn't giving too much away right there at the beginning, but she was sort of preparing readers. And there are moments in the book that, you know, I look at the book as a book of light with shadows and patches of darkness. I don't look at it as a dark book with just slivers of light, because, you know, I like that balance. And I think for Betty, she's preparing the reader in many ways to, when they come to those parts in the book that might be more tragic or more heartbreaking, that she's able to kind of foreshadow those events as a kind of preparation. And when I look at it, when I look at Betty, who was coming of age in this family, there were so many secrets around her that maybe she wasn't tuned into them from a very early age, yet she sort of always had this antenna where she was feeling these subtle vibrations. And I see that this story in the beginning is giving those same subtle vibrations that she herself would have experienced. And so we're working up to where we get that signal that is so full and strong. So I think she uses it because also when I look at this book, I also look at it as Betty, who is sitting there at the typewriter. You know, people ask, who exactly is Betty telling the story to? And so when I think of this novel and I think how it's written, I imagine Betty, who is an older woman, she's sitting in a room in her house and she's at the typewriter her father had given her, and she's still feeling all the ripples of those years at her fingertips. And so for me, the story is she's using those processes and those foreshadowings as a way to build up to those moments that maybe she herself would have appreciated at that younger age as well.
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting way to look at it, because she's telling the story to us, but she's also telling the story in a way to herself, or rediscovering a story she's already written through many years, because she kind of was writing this stuff down as a girl too, right?
Right. Yeah, it is. It's like she's telling this story to herself too. And I tend to use that device quite often, you know, in The Summer That Melted Everything, it was Fielding who was kind of telling him his own self that story. And in this case, it's really Betty rediscovering those moments as well. And we see her as someone as a kid when she's writing these stories, she'll write them and then she'll dig a hole and she'll bury those stories into
right.
the earth. So this moment in her life, her telling this story, is really just her saying, I'm not going to bury these things anymore. And she's really digging her hands into the earth and she's pulling them up and she's sort of seeing what she has there. But it's a discovery for her as much as it is for the reader.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, there's so much going on in this book. I love that there's so much going on, because it was just very interesting. So one of the things I'm always interested to know how people find the epigrams that they choose for the openings of their book. And as you already mentioned, yours is a poem that Betty wrote. But you also have these biblical references at the start of each chapter. I believe they're all from the Bible. I'm wondering how you went about finding those and deciding which ones went where and what was the best place you know, they in some cases they seem to herald what's coming, and in some cases they seem to transition us a little bit from what's just been, which I also enjoyed. So do you want to just talk about how you find those?
Absolutely, yeah. So we use both quotes from the Bible and those start our chapters off, but we also have section breaks where we sort of use wording from the Bible as well. And in those parts, I wanted to use all the names that Jesus had been called in the Bible. So we have the horn of salvation, we have life. And so I wanted to use sort of everything that he had been called that represented all of these good things and these blessings from the Bible as this section breaks, while the quotes also really represented the not so great things, the things that could be considered sexist within the novel, that could be problematic. You know, historically, the Cherokee culture was a matriarchal, matrilineal society, and that's sort of the history that Betty has and the history that Landon instills in her. And yet Betty is living in a world where Christianity has positioned men at the top. And so I hope the use of the biblical quotes would really reference that patriarchy while showing Betty is coming of age in both worlds. And I think that, you know, that when she's, because I think back to that scene in the book where she's with the principal and he's telling her, you know, girls and women, they should just wear skirts and dresses. They can't wear pants. And then at the home, you know, Landon is telling her women are valued and they're important and they're powerful regardless of what they're wearing. And so you see Betty as someone who has a history that is supporting women through the Cherokee culture, but then she's also sort of struggling to fit in and find her place in societies where Christianity is more the norm. And so I wanted to use those biblical quotes as a sort of intro to highlight what she is up against. But I did the quotes after I wrote the chapter. I didn't want to, you know, the quotes to direct the chapter. So I would write the chapter and then I would find a quote in the novel or in the Bible that really sort of spoke to the issues within that chapter. But for me, they really sort of highlight and then kind of show just a different obstacle on Betty's path as she's sort of trying to reckon living in these societies and these communities, but also sort of finding that uplifting tone where she can sort of rise above it and she can really embrace her gender and her sisters can embrace their sisterhood and all these things that maybe Christianity wasn't telling them was important.
Yeah. That's funny. That was my next point about what I found really interesting was just these facts about what had changed for the Cherokee people after the whites came to this country, after Christians came to this country. And I wrote down this sentence: before Christianity, the Cherokee celebrated being a matriarchal and matrilineal society. Women were at the head of the household, but Christianity positioned men at the top. So that was really interesting to me that you bring that up right now, too.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to know about a little bit is what in the book is fiction and what in the book comes from your mother's actual history and story? And I don't want you to give anything away in answering that question, but is there a lot that you had to fill in around your mother's actual stories?
Well, it was helpful because I started doing the Q&A sessions with her and, you know, I was able to listen to her experiences with racism and sexism. And so those things are coming from a true place. And I also, you know, listened to how she was bullied in school. And, you know, Ruthus became a character who was inspired by several different bullies. I kind of molded them into one. And so those sorts of experiences that mom had, those were all coming from that place of truth and that place that she experienced. And then I had Q&A sessions with you know, other family members, and including Lynn, who deals with mental illness in the book. And, you know, when you're talking to someone who has dealt with those issues, it gives you an inside look at their brain and sort of what they were experiencing growing up. And, you know, I have fond memories with that uncle, but I also knew that he was struggling. And, you know, he would ultimately die from an overdose. And in the book, I was able to, you know, look at those sessions with him and kind of give him a happier ending. So those are the things that fiction allowed me to do in the book. It allowed me to sort of take those things, but also then give them an ending that maybe those people in real life didn't have. And I also reflect back on, you know, my sessions with Mama Alka, who in the book, you know, we learn that she has a very difficult and traumatic past. I don't want to give too much away there, but we learn that she experienced a lot as a child, and, you know, having to hear that firsthand and to listen to her speak about those abuses, it kind of, you know, it puts a face to that abuse. And I really wanted to preserve those details of her story that were really told from a place of such pain and hurt for her. And I look at, you know, her mother and her father, who were both part of the abuse she experienced. And, you know, I remember the details she had told me where her mother had actually carried her into the bedroom to her father. And so I wanted to preserve those details that was important enough for Mama to share. I think she was sharing them because she wanted to show that, you know, she was really alone in this house with her parents. And so, you know, I look at those moments and I look at Landon Chu, who, you know, I want to preserve the way he valued and supported his children. And so I kind of took those things that were kind of said to me, and I used fiction as a vehicle in which to bring that to the page, or like I said before, in a way to kind of give a character a happier ending than maybe they had in real life. So in some scenes served as a bridge, and other scenes it served as a frame. But you know, the beautiful thing about fiction is that if you unravel it back to the beginning thread, you can unravel it back to that truth. And so fiction really was used as a way to just support, wrap, and kind of convey these experiences of these people to the page.
Yeah. Now, there's this line in the book that just jumped out at me. It was so perfect. And now you've just mentioned Ruthus. You write in the book, "There are no small wars between girls. Everything is as epic as two wild birds sparring over the last worm." I loved that. I thought that was fantastic. Now, you occasionally offer other sources of story that kind of bring something else to the narrative and kind of vary the narrative in an interesting way. So one of the things is the epigrams we mentioned. Another is the news stories. So you include news stories from a newspaper that you call the Brethanian. Now, they live in a town called Breathed, which I also was interested in. And then I remembered, isn't that from your other book as well? Is it the same town?
It is, yep. Breathed was actually born when I first wrote Betty, because Betty was the first novel I ever wrote. And then The Summon About Everything just happened to be my first published novel. And so when I was writing Betty, Breathed was a fictional name, but it was inspired by the town Mom had grown up in and the town that I would later grow up in. And I really just love the dynamics of Breathed and the setting. And so I've used it for the majority of my novels. So you'll see that sort of come back. And because it takes place in Breathed, I was able to drop in some brief character mentions from The Summer That Melts Everything in Betty, even though Betty is inspired by these people. It gave me the chance to sort of just slip in that little thank you to readers of The Summer That Melts Everything by kind of connecting those characters. But yeah, I think Breathed to me is a character itself, and I think it's something that I'll always, a town I'll always be returning to.
Yeah, okay, that's great. So you have the Brethanian, which is the newspaper in Breathed, and you include news stories, and they kind of build on each other. So the early on, you have a story about windows being shattered in the dead of the night, and then it turns to guns being fired, and the stories build, and they you know, your characters react to the stories, but for a long time we really don't know if they have any direct involvement in what's being reported, and I liked that as a storytelling tool. And I don't want you to give anything away about what these stories lead to, but I do just sort of want to talk about including another source to a story and what that does for you as an author and for the narrative itself.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of use those articles as a way to pull out of the family. So we're very much involved in this family. And of course, Betty is telling the story. So we're in her head and we're through her voice. And the articles really gave us a chance to sort of step out and get those glimpses of, you know, the town's response to them. And one of the articles, you know, we do have a gunfire and people are curious who is firing this gun. And there's a quote right. that they give one of the citizens of the town and they say, "I don't trust anyone whose face blends into the night." And so it's a sort of subtle way of saying there is racism in this town and this family has just moved into it. And so we have them who are being looked at as suspects just because they are brown skinned living in this community. So I use the articles as a way to sort of slip in those subtle attitudes of the town without sort of really throwing it in the reader's face. And the articles gave us a chance to step outside the Carpenter family and step into the minds of the citizens of this community. And I really, you know, I think about those articles at the very end and how they circle back around and we get a quote from in one of the last articles. And she says, "I hope that, you know, this person finally said what it was they were hoping to say." And it reflects so much on Betty because we see her as someone who is at the end of the story completely different than she was at the beginning. And this
yes.
this gunfire to the town, even though they might not have understood it in the beginning, was really another type of story being told. And so we see that story of gunfire and that story of the Carpenter family running side by side. And so I really liked how the article sort of help support the narrative in that way.
Yeah. Now you've mentioned the racism a couple times, so let's talk about that. Now there was incredible racism, even, and I suppose I'm naive to think this is shocking, but even from her teachers, so difficult. You know, when she gets to school and the kids are being mean to her, that's the point where I feel like this teacher's going to step in and protect her and. Oh my goodness, just so not.
Yeah.
It was just so painful. It was so hard to read. I mean, everybody has experienced cruelty as a child, but this is, you know, when the adults are against you, it feels like all is lost. So, and that's not the only hard thing in the book. There's a lot of difficult stuff in the book. There's a lot of cruelty. And I wonder if you can talk about writing cruelty, whether it be racism or cruelty to women or cruelty to children or animals, you know, whatever. Like, can you talk a little bit about how you manage that and how you prepare yourself for that?
Yeah. And what I was going to say about the teachers, too, is something that stuck out to me in my sessions with Mom when she was talking about the bullying at school. And it was surprising to learn. It wasn't just students, but it was teachers as well. And I remember she was talking about, it's not in the book, but she was talking about career day at school and they were going to this fair and the teacher had told her, "You stay behind, Betty, because you're not going to do anything with your life anyways." And so there was this, not just from her peers, but from the teachers as well, which carried their, you know, they harbored their own racist ideologies in this small town. And so she was really up against that as well. And I also remembered a heartbreaking, it's not in the book either, a heartbreaking detail where Betty returns to school after her father's death and the teacher uses a racial slur to ask her if her father had really died. And so it's showing that there's still, even in that death, even though he was significant to his family and his friends, there was still this really heavily, you know, this racism that they were up against. And about writing about that cruelty and sort of the different sides of it, I've always been someone who likes to find that balance within the writing world. And so I think that you also have to write not just about the good things, but the bad things as well. Because mm-hmm. when you have too much of the good things, maybe it doesn't allow you to kind of really appreciate all those good things in your life. And when you have something that counters that, it really causes you to appreciate that more. And so when I was writing about these more painful parts of the story, I understood that it was a way to sort of balance those characters and to balance their histories and what they've gone through. You know, I look at Alk and I look at that scene in the book between her and Betty in the bedroom with the cats. And I won't get too much away there, but I look at Alka as someone who was having a mental break. You know, she was someone who dealt with this history that she had experienced her whole life. And you know, growing up, I always knew Alka could be two sides of a person. You know, she could be really sweet and loving one moment, and then the next moment she could be really distant and hard to reach. And so I didn't understand that when I was a child. And then, of course, when I was older and I had learned what she had gone through, it made much more sense that she had become the woman she had become. And so, you know, you're writing about these things and you're trying to balance it with those lighter moments. And for me, the cruelty is something that allows us to see all sides of that person, and to understand what they've gone through and kind of how those experiences have shaped them.
Mm-hmm. Another aspect to the racism in the book, and this is really actually going along with what you say about the balance that you like to include. And earlier you said something about light and shadow and including both. So having talked about the racism, I just want to talk about the way that you so beautifully juxtapose the hatred against Landon's kindness and wisdom, the lessons he teaches from his Native American background. You know, he's treated inferior specifically around that culture, and yet in so many ways here we see that culture to be, you know, if not straight superior, then certainly valuable, respectful of the earth. I would say superior, but anyway. And so I loved that juxtaposition. I just thought that it was lovely, and it made me care more about his character and about his influence over his family. And I'm wondering if that's part of what you're talking about, that balance.
Oh, yeah, definitely. When I look at Landon, going back to that nature and that respect for it, you know, I really look back at Papaw as an environmentalist and someone who really wanted to preserve the ecosystem. And I think that that's something that Mom passed on to us. She raised me and my sisters in gardens, and she was one of three sisters, and as fate would have it, she had three daughters. And so she raised us with that gardening technique of the three sisters, which was adopted by many different Native American tribes. But Landon really connected through that technique through his Cherokee ancestry. And so that was a way that he brought the culture and the tradition into his children's lives. And that was also the pathway through which Mom introduced me and my sisters to it as well. You know, she'd have us out in the garden and she would talk about the stories and she would talk about Landon. And that was really an opportunity for him to live on and for that culture to live on. And, you know, we see him as someone in this community. He's, you know, he's making these tonics and these different teas and recipes, which was something that he had done in real life. And we see him not saying, you know, plants will be a cure-all, but it's something that can be of help for those things that can be helped. And so we see the community members coming to him with their aches and pains. And even when they're getting something from him, I'm remembering back to that one neighbor who asked him if he takes feathers for payment or beads or any of that nature. So there was still this racism that he was facing even when they were coming to him and asking him for these things.
Right.
But what I respected so much about Landon was that he didn't counter that hate with a hate of his own. He sort of just tried to educate them. You know, he said, I don't take feathers. I don't take beads. I will take money. And same as anybody. And so I think he was really trying to counter that behavior and just show that he was just like they were, only he had this culture and this experience that was just as valuable as their culture. And I think that he was someone who, you know, he didn't think that he was better than anybody, but he felt like he had something that was important to offer and kind of something that should be shared equally in the community. And so, you know, I look at him, especially his teachings of nature and wildlife and how important it is to live in harmony. Those were things that I feel so blessed that were passed down to me and my sisters as well. And that's really through those things that I really connect and identify with him the most. And, you know, every time I'm out in the garden, I think about him. And every time I plant a seed, I think about him. And so he has lived on in those moments and his passion for nature and his hope that it would be preserve for generations to come.
Wonderful. Tiffany, I want to ask you about the title of the book. The book is called Betty, and I'm just wondering if that was the working title as you drafted it. You said you worked on this a long time ago. Did the title ever change? Did your publisher like the title you had come up with, just being your mom's name, the character's name, whatever? How did that go?
Well, it actually did start out with a different title, and I had to used kind of a different nickname that mom had had, which was Betty. And so when the book caught on contract, and I just had this feeling like we should just not use this nickname. We should really use your name. And mom was, of course, comfortable with it, and she was happy with that. And so I just felt like Betty was such a powerful name. And, I brought it to the publisher. I said, I would really love to scrap the title that we had. I'd really love to title the book Betty. And at first, there was some hesitancy. My editor said it made him think about Betty Draper from Mad Men and things like that. So I think that there were still some things that we had to sort of get over in terms of thinking about who the Bettys of the world can be, and that they're not just these archetypes that we see on television or something like that, but they're the names of these women who are strong and powerful and making strides in, medicine and technology. And Betty really represented this individual within that, that chorus of voices. And so I think it was taken to the publisher there at Knopf, who really loved it. And so we got the green light on using that as the title, and I was so happy about it because Betty, to me, really represents what the book is about, which is about strength and power and womanhood and kind of finding who we are. And I really couldn't think of any other title that would represent the book so well and kind of represent the path of these characters better.
Yeah, it's interesting. She had the least unusual name of her siblings. Her siblings had, I mean, did you use all the real names?
No, I had changed some things. So Landon and Alka, those are, and Betty. And then I decided to change some names because when I was writing about the two at the beginning of the book, Yarrow and Wakanda, who died pretty young, and I was thinking, well, they're not here to sort of say that, so I decided to change their names, and they died as an infant and a toddler. And once I did that, I decided to sort of do that as a sort of blanket approach to the characters and things like that. But I wanted to keep Betty and Landon and Alka intact as the way in. But to be respectful and kind of to just also be mindful of privacy, I decided to change the other names.
Okay. And you made really interesting choices. So Freya and Flossie and Yarrow and Trustin and Lint. How do you come up with your character names? I was sort of assuming maybe these were their actual names.
I sort of gravitate toward those names that kind of say something about the person. And, I did the same thing with the Summer That Melted Everything, which had very odd names like Autopsy and stuff like that. And,
right.
People ask, well, why did you name him that? And I said, well, the whole book was kind of this autopsy that Fielding was performing on himself. And so with names, I do try to find a sort of approach to say something more about the character. And Lint is coming to mind. And he says in the book, I'm named after the stuff you find in your belly button. I'm just this fluff and I don't matter. And Betty, of course, is telling him, no, you do matter. And your name actually has a greater meaning behind it. And she comes up with this story on the spot of how his name is important to who he is. And it, she's very much taking her father's approach in that way. And so I wanted to look at the characters and kind of find a name that fits them. And when I look at Freya, too, who we say in the book, her brother would call her Frey as if she was a piece of something or something coming undone.
Yeah.
And so we have those moments where we can really use name as a way to talk about these characters without doing it directly. It's kind of an indirect approach. And so for names, I think I do tend to come up with uncommon ones. But in the case of Betty, I like that her name felt so common amongst them because it was something that kind of united them. It sort of united maybe the uncommon feeling of these other names, and hers really sort of centered it all, you know, Betty, mm-hmm. and out of that comes these other siblings. And so names is just the indirect way for me to sort of give more meaning to the characters.
Great. Okay. I want to take just a minute to talk about your beautiful descriptions and your details and your imagery, not just because they're beautiful. I think a lot of what people say about your work is that the language is really incredible and resonant, but it means more than just the beauty behind it. I have a few examples. One, and this is just a detail that really hit me, but the license plate state games on long rides, you know, and they actually are using this as a way to, ultimately you have it be a way that they get back to Ohio. But I remember being on long rides and, you know, just to kill the time, you and your siblings are trying to find all the states. That was a great... This analogy was so perfect. After the many details that you share about this dark, broken house with this sad past, this sentence is so perfect. Stepping into the house was like crossing the threshold into a tomb. That was great. And then sometimes your details have much deeper meaning. So, for example, I never thought about it early in the book, although I remembered it, but you have this analogy when Langdon meets Alka, you have this line, "The color and texture of her hair reminded him of pale wisps of corn silk in the light of the sun." And then later, corn silk has more concrete importance, and he tries to teach his kids how to know when corn is ripe and not ruin it by stripping the silk too early. You know, and I don't know if that was on purpose or not, but at this point, that earlier reference took on more meaning for me. I was wondering if that was intentional, and also just how much of this is organic to your writing, that kind of deeper meaning, and how much is put in there on purpose, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. So with the corn... it goes back to the three sisters, and Landon says the three sisters were the most important crop, and they were maize, beans, and squash, and they grow together because they complement each other, but because they also benefit each other. You know, the corn is the stalks for the beans to climb up, so it's a support structure. The beans give nitrogen, the squash protects, and so we see him applying this idea to his daughters, which Freya being the oldest, she's maize, and Flossie is beans, and Betty is squash. And when I was going back and kind of looking at Freya's character, and she represents the corn, and we have those glimpses of corn throughout the novel, and mm-hmm. especially in regards to Leland and the way that he approaches corn. You know, Landon tells his son, "You have to stop opening the corn because you're ruining it." And, you know, we see Leland sort of barreling in there and still destroying the corn, even though that he knows that, you know, it should be protected and it should be respected. And we see him as someone who is countering that and as someone who is destroying it. And we have a scene later in the novel where Betty is in the corn and she sees Leland doing this. And, of course, without giving too much away, that destruction means so much more to her than him just opening an ear of corn. And so right. We do have those moments throughout the novel where we're sort of laying the groundwork for the things to come. You know, I think about the bees and the imagery of the bees throughout the book and how Betty is, you know, in that one scene, she's has the bee in her hands and she feels a sting. And that, of course, comes later within the novel. So I won't go into detail on that because that will give a kind of major spoiler away.
Right.
But
right.
I like to use that imagery to connect, and I think it helps that I do write poetry, and so you're sort of putting in meaning in very few lines, and that's sort of the application that I use when I'm writing novels, is that I'll sort of apply those very brief mentions that has a much greater meaning, and then I sort of circle back around to that. I like that approach. I feel like it gives the reader time to prepare for that. It sort of lays the groundwork. It sort of lays those hints. And then when the big thing that we're building up to at the end comes back around, they can sort of look back and say, oh, I saw the breadcrumbs here. So it's really just about laying that path so that readers, when they get to the end of it, they can then find those crumbs back to the beginning and see that, oh, those sorts of little things were laid here and there for me along the way.
Yeah. I always love finding those things too. It's just fun. Let's see. So I want to know if you've read any books lately by other authors that you have enjoyed and might recommend to listeners.
Oh gosh. Well, actually, what I've been reading lately has been kind of, I've been reading, cause I have a neighbor who was spraying pesticides and things. So my reading has been reading up on pesticide application and kind of environmental effects of that. And sort of, you know, it really affected our frog population. So I've been reading up on kind of how to build that back up and kind of the habitat for that. So my reading lately has been very environmentally driven. And then I'm also writing a book that takes place in the 1800s. So I've been reading history books on that. So I haven't been reading kind of literature at the moment, but I still like that nonfiction reading because I feel like it still enriches us and it still gives us the opportunity to sort of learn things that, you know, still feel very literary, but it's also delivered in sort of that scope that allows us to kind of be more educated along the way. So my reading has been pretty centered on those things at the moment.
Okay. All right. That's great. And actually, my next question was going to be, what are you working on next? So it sounds like you're working on historical fiction with an environmental focus.
Well, actually, the book that takes place in the 1800s is actually a bit of a ghost story. That one is.
Oh,
and then,
fun.
Yeah. And then I'm also working on two other books at the moment. So I'm balancing between three. But that one with the 1800s that has a much more historical approach. So I have to do a bit more research and kind of the culture of the time. But I'm sort of balancing between three different books. I'll work on one and I'll go work on the other, which is kind of a nice approach because then you're sort of coming to each work with fresh eyes. But it also gives me the chance that when something comes to me, I can kind of pivot to that other book and sort of make some progress there. So
yeah, okay.
Working on three at the moment.
Wow. Okay. And I think I conflated your pesticide neighbor with what you're working on. So I'm sorry about that. Let's see. I like to end these interviews by asking for some advice for writers who might be listening. And in your case, I wanted to ask for advice for including smaller stories that have to do with characters that are external to the main story as a way of building the main story. So, for example, you have a character in Betty named Old Cotton, and Old Cotton is not a man of color, but his wife was, and she was hanged, tortured and hanged. And ever since then, Cotton writes her a letter every day and rolls the letter up and puts it inside a balloon and lets it fill with helium, and he releases it. And that was a wonderful image, a sad story, a wonderful image. And finding one of these letters becomes important to Betty, and I think, if I'm not misremembering this, it sort of further inspires her own writing and her own hiding of her stories. And I thought that sort of amplified the larger narrative. But I think finding a story like that of Old Cotton or that of the peacocks and using it to amplify the story you're working on is a really interesting thing to be able to do. And I wonder if you have any advice around that.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I love using those sort of external characters that really support the main characters that we're talking about. And when you bring up Cotton and you bring up the peacocks, and I actually have books about them. So Cotton's is already written, and then the peacocks is a book that I plan to write. So a lot of times with these external characters, I'll have them have brief appearances in a novel that maybe isn't necessarily about them, but they'll come back in a novel that is their book to be told later on. And so for me, I look at it as building that Breathed universe, especially because I've been using Breathed in the majority of my novels. And so it's become this ever evolving character. And within that, we have that cast of character that, you know, that is continually growing. And so the advice that I would give for people who are kind of working with a town or kind of a larger cast is to just kind of build those relationships between the main characters and those external characters, because that then will bring those external characters much more into the fold, and it'll make their presence on the page that much more valuable to the core of the story that you're telling. But the external characters, what they do offer as well, is to give us that chance to step outside of the main focus. And so they can also change our perspective, but they can also keep the lens on those issues that we're wanting to kind of come face to face with. So the external characters really serve so many purposes. And I think because I do look at them as characters who will become main characters in their own books down the road, I build them in a way that their presence in these books will be remembered enough to where they're then brought back into those books later on. They'll be remembered for their effects on the main family or the main characters within those previous books. And so that's definitely my advice, is to use those external characters to build and support and really be part of that frame around those core characters and around those core ideas that you're hoping to deliver to the reader.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wonderful. Tiffany McDaniel, I want to mention again the name of the new novel coming out on the 18th of August is Betty. It's based on the life of your mother, and it's published by Knopf. Tiffany McDaniel, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It was really a pleasure.
Oh, gosh, thank you so much. I'm so grateful for the opportunity. It was fantastic.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Tiffany McDaniel. You can learn more about her work at her website, tiffanymcdaniel.com. In the interview with Tiffany, we talked about bringing deeper meaning to detail. In Tiffany's case, she brought deeper meaning to the corn silk that shows up throughout the book. Corn, of course, being part of a Native American story about the meanings of different sisters, but also being part of their lives, and also representing, because of that Native American story, also representing more than it seems as the story unfolds. So this week's Write the Book prompt is to try to bring deeper meaning into a detail that has already showed up in your work. Don't force something in there, but look for something that can mean something more, something that will enrich what you're trying to bring to the page. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. We're at that point in the show again where we talk about the pandemic. I hope that you are doing all right. I hope you and your loved ones are well, safe, comfortable as we can be. Whatever else you may be doing, I hope you're still able to read and to write. And if possible, I hope you're supporting other authors by attending their online events, reading their blogs, following their virtual book tours, and finding your way to their books. It's a weird time to launch a book, and we have to try to support people as best we can. For all of you who are trying to write these days, be sure to check the archives of the show, because each episode does offer a prompt written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview, which also announces the prompt. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors, if you have events to announce. And then be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. The show is also on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can access the podcast at my own website as well, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. ShaylaConnorShapiro.com also gets you there if you can figure out how to spell it. If you like the show, please rate it on iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV, LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.